Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, Ryzen 3000 benchmarks along with AMD's new 5700 Navi GPUs, Vega is dead, people, NVIDIA Super GPUs, and Nintendo Switch Lite. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 524, recorded on July 11th, 2019. AMD launch eats Intel's lunch. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/Twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch Weekly Show. The name is to bring you the most useful, most delightful, most engaging, most affordable, most exciting, most cringeworthy, and occasionally the most saturated video and audio about hardware available in this universe or any known or unknown universe anywhere. Anyhow, I'm Patrick Norton, joined by someone who's a little freaking tired of benchmarking, Sebastian Peake from PCPer.com. Where should we start with yet another glorious week of AMD news?
Yeah, AMD. And then, of course, NVIDIA inserted themselves into the conversation. So that's something that happened. But, yeah, I mean, I want to make these I survived 7.7 shirts and then send them out to all the other editors, too. I thought about adding some incomprehensible garbled nonsense after that to sort of pay tribute to what was happening on my keyboard. It was about 6:45 a.m. early morning of the 7th. I'd pulled an all-nighter and I was trying to finish everything, and I literally was at the keyboard trying to type a word.
Speaking
I don't remember
tongues.
Which word it was. Yeah, and it was just like every key was wrong. Like, what is this? H-Y-T-Z, what? And I finally just passed out, woke up again at 8:30, freaking out to go proofread the review again and make sure it got up on time. But yeah, I think everybody kind of drove themselves to distraction with this. If you think about it, you asked where to begin. Well, let's see. New Ryzen processors, new graphics cards released on the same day from AMD with a new architecture. Both of these are brand new architectures. And then a brand new platform, the X570 platform. And oh, by the way, right in the middle of this, the Super came out, the NVIDIA Super. And of course, we didn't have a show last week, so we didn't talk about that. But that came out on the 2nd. So,
well, we were sort of overwhelmed. It was such an... You know, is it cold to call it an underwhelming announcement? Well, okay, let's start. I have this note in the rundown from earlier this week. Oh, hey, AMD 3950X ships with a crappy BIOS, which is okay because you won't find one for sale anyhow. And we'll talk about that not being able to find one for sale in a minute. You got... You got hands on with the 3700X, the 3900X. Supposedly the 3950X shipped, although I don't know if any shipped outside of Micro Center stores in part of the U.S. I joked with you like, oh, I should have stayed up till 1 a.m. last night like I usually do, because then I might have been able to order off of Newegg one of the new 3000 series. AMD Ryzen 7 processors, which were all sold out by like 6:15 in the morning when I found the email from Newegg. So you called it disruptive force, which to me sounds like, ooh, that must be so delete expletive fast. But it was a really mixed experience. Pound, sometimes benchmarking is really painful, and I wish they finished products before they ship them. I mean, is that a safe assessment at this point, or are things cleaning themselves up?
There's two issues. One, the platform. So AMD sent out reviewers kits, which included processor, memory, motherboard. And if you were using the supplied X570 motherboards, depending on which ones you got, there were some issues with one of them. There were issues with I only got two. So the one was completely unusable. The other one worked, except it didn't boost. There was no turbo boost. It was reporting 3.8 gigahertz on the 3900X as the base and boost clock speed. And I was like, it's just being misreported. So I started running benchmarks. And I was watching core behavior during the benchmark runs, and it wasn't moving above 3.8. It was actually going down to 3.79. So Something was definitely wrong.
Overclock.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the new negative boost. And that was obviously a problem. So I think the 5th they released an update to this, but we're talking like firmware updates coming down between the 7th and 5th, and even some of them coming down as late as the 6th or 7th for a launch of 7.7 when reviewers, in theory, would have had time to benchmark all this stuff. I was holding out to the last possible minute, and then I still got hit with issues and firmware updates on the 5th. So,
this is one of the reasons why so many companies, for example, classic example, Apple, they want to control things, they want to have the best possible experience, so they decouple the launch dates for products as much as possible from any sort of like it's going to ship on or this day. Not entirely true, but certainly they no longer like we're going to have a new thing at Macworld, we're going to have a new thing at this event. Roughly speaking, they do announce the new phones and stuff at given times, but they had some issues with firmware when they launched the original Ryzen processors. Mostly that was around memory speed and overclocking. Not as vicious as this. Is this a reason not to buy this processor at this point? Or maybe to sort of wait for 570 motherboards to be a little bit more finished?
I think this was mostly just an issue that reviewers encountered, that retail boards, like the one board I had an issue with was an MSI board. There was a resistor problem. Something was wrong in the pre-release version. The retail version does not have that problem. I was talking to their support guy in Taiwan, and it's just basically the stuff that they had to work with leading up to the launch. There were some issues that have been fixed at this point. The one major issue, and I would say like there's absolutely nothing wrong with the processors. Like I would say either wait on X570 or if you already have like a 2000 series processor to update the BIOS, if you encountered any issues, it really any X570 board you get will be in some sort of bootable state. So you can at least update to the newest firmware. One of the things that happened over the last few days, and this was on Twitter, I know some of the reviewers from Anantech who did the CPU review over there, the AGESA code changed version. So from the second and starting on the 2nd, depending on the manufacturer, and leading up to the 5th, that's when my Asus BIOS came down. It went from 1.0.0.2 to 1.0.0.3a. There's a 3ab. And these affect things like the boost behavior and that sort of thing. So if you don't have the latest BIOS, if you get an X570 board, just update it. They all have it at this point, just on their regular like customer support download pages. So. But once you have that installed, you're getting the full performance out of these CPUs. And X470 is a great solution for these too. I ended up having to do my testing on X470 because of my stability and some memory issues I was having with the one board. And I had absolutely no issues running on an X470 board with the 3700X, the 3900X running 3200 DDR4. Absolutely flawless, no blue screens ever, no stability issues at all. So I don't think there's an issue with these CPUs, other than availability. But if you can get your hands on one, even if you only have a 400 series board, perfectly fine. And then the X570 boards, are fine too. Just make sure you update them and you'll get proper boost behavior. So it, like I said, retail channel, a different story from what the reviewers were facing with these pre-release products where they're just kind of rushing them out there.
This is good.
And they were,
So
no reason to hesitate.
Okay. So, we should also point out this is sometimes how tight things get when they're trying to get things to reviewers early. Let me point out the Ryzen 9 3950X, that is not supposed to ship until September. Now, the Ryzen 9 3900X, which started shipping in theory 7/7/2019, that is fundamentally impossible to find right now.
Correct.
One of the things that I was kind of delighted by was the pretty hefty drops in prices on the 2700, and then, for example, 2700's down like $250, 2600X's are at $160. But I'm checking Newegg right now, and they've got a Ryzen 3 1300X, a 3400G, a 3600. They've got like a couple of Ryzen 5s, a couple of Ryzen 3s, and nothing else from the 3000 series at this point. I'm also going to turn off the additional sellers. You know, as a caveat emptor, for anybody who thinks they may have found one being sold by a third party on Amazon, be really careful about that, because I was laughing. Somebody's like, you know, who doesn't normally sell processors was claiming that they had Ryzen 7 CPUs, which is amusing, given that, as you discovered by a quick search, that they had been importing sort of crappy kitchenware from China up until suddenly becoming a CPU sales organization. So, you know, the rumors about the Ryzen 9s from third-party vendors or Ryzen 7s from third-party vendors are probably not legit. And this is crazy.
I'm still,
okay,
still waiting on that. One of our readers who's in our public Discord server, they've been keeping us updated because they ordered one from the so-called Amazon or AMD authorized reseller on Amazon. The former kitchen gadget seller. He's been keeping us updated. He's got tracking. He's supposed to get it, I think, tomorrow or Saturday. Really? And now a review has popped up claiming that, oh, yeah, I got it. Everything's fine. So he's like, Jay, look, the reviews are in. Like, well, reviews, you know, on Amazon have been known to be
faked.
Faked before. So, yeah, I will not believe it until he has it in hand. And right. Boots up a system and runs benchmarks to prove this isn't just a rebranded 2700. They didn't just write a 3 over the 2 and you have a 2700X in your hands. But
they are a touch more sophisticated than that. So Amazon's got Ryzen 5 3600Xs. That's the 6-core, 12-thread. And nothing fast. That's the fastest. That's pretty much the fastest AMD Ryzen 3000 series you can buy right now. It's the 6-core, 12-thread Ryzen 5, which makes me wonder. Well, okay, before I ask if you think this is a yield issue or an actual, you know, pent-up demand issue, I'm assuming that yields on these are pretty low at this point. What did you think of the 3900X compared to the 2700X and compared to what's available from Intel?
If you look at some of the charts, the 3700X and 3900X have tremendous performance. It, depending on the benchmark, they sometimes even lead on single core performance. But really where their bread and butter is going to be multi-threaded. So if you have a multi-threaded workload and, you know, Cinebench numbers, that sort of thing are what they are. And of course, the 3900X absolutely dominates that. But depending on your workload, you're getting just phenomenal power from this because it's 12 cores. If you compare it against anything on Intel's desktop side right now, where it tops out 8 cores, 16 threads with the 9900K currently for around $500, 3900X at the same price point, if you can find it, you're getting the benefit of all those extra cores, which that's everything. So it's 4 more cores, 8 more threads. And it looks like it in the benchmarks. It's not like this is falling short of the 9900K, even though it looks faster on paper. It looks faster on paper. It's faster in real life, depending on the benchmark. And we'll talk about gaming, but just for any of the quick benchmarks I was able to run, I did as many as I could, but you're talking about things like video compression or you know transcoding, compression, decompression with 7-zip. I ran one of the older CPU POV Ray. It's a CPU-based ray tracing benchmark, Cinebench, just to get a feel for what these could do in single and multi-threaded performance versus Intel. And it was great. I mean, the older POV Ray, Intel kind of wiped the floor on single core. But then, of course, you go to multi-thread, which is how you're actually going to be running it. And it just destroys the $500 9900K. So they definitely lived up to the promise of the benefits of the new architecture and moving to 7-nanometer, they're able to do things like the 3700X, which is only a 65-watt part and frequently outperforming a 9900K, which is rated at 95 watts. But you know, everything consumes more power under these bigger loads. Like Cinebench is almost a power virus when it's running in all-core mode. But the 65-watt 3700X was not pulling very much power out of the wall, even under that kind of stress. I think the total was around 130 watts, which includes the, you know, the motherboard, the chipset, the memory, and then the inefficiency of the power supply, which in this case I think was only a gold-rated power supply. So you have to discount that as well. But just very, very impressive. 132 watts from the wall was the 3700X. And if you look at...
That's impressive.
Yeah, and look at like the previous generation. The 2700X was pulling 203, exact same motherboard, exact same power supply, right. Everything the same, except I swapped out the CPUs, ran the test again. You're going significantly better performance than a 2700X for the same price, yet you're drawing 70 fewer watts in the process and don't need the same kind of cooling. Like the 3700X is not a hot CPU.
So that was one of the craziest things, because you pointed out that Anantec has this fantastic discussion of the chips and the architecture. But, you know, they were saying, like, they were looking at something like the neighborhood of 32% lower. Well, it manages to showcase 32% lower absolute power than the 2700X, comparing the 2700X and the 3700X. Yeah. That's really impressive, you know, to boost clock speeds by 100 megahertz, to, you know, boost the amount of work that's being done and to lower the power consumption. This is the kind of things we were looking at Intel and being amazed by a few years ago. And now AMD is doing it sort of at a much more accelerated pace, it feels like. I mean, that's just a huge drop. How much of that do you think is due to the 7-nanometer process or moving down to the 7-nanometer process?
We were talking about this here, and it's some of it is 7-nanometer for sure, but the architecture is really where they made these huge leaps in performance. So like we saw with Radeon 7, you can move down. Essentially, Radeon 7 was a die shrink. It was taking the Vega chip that was shipping in the Vega 64, same configuration. It was still 64 CUs, same number of streaming processors. They increased the memory. They boosted memory throughput because they added two more memory channels, that sort of thing. But essentially, you're dealing with the same GPU die, just die shrink down to 7-nanometers and clocked up. So it pulled almost the same amount of power, but they were able to get higher clocks. And when you go down to a smaller process, you can make choices like that. Like, do I want to focus on efficiency? So they could have done this with the 3700X versus the 27. They could have said, let's make something that consumes way, way less power, but, you know, still has the same level of performance. And what they were able to do, because this architecture is so much better, Zen 2 versus Zen Plus, it's just not even close. The biggest jump on the charts is going to be going from Zen Plus to Zen 2, way, way more than we saw from Zen to Zen Plus. Zen Plus was really just a die shrink, where they kind of massaged it and got some more performance out of it. And Zen 2 was just all new architecture and way, way more efficient. Everything from the very beginning. Cache is another big one with these. Cache sizes have gone way up, and that helps them. And the way that the CCX units are communicating is different. Everything has been improved, and we've seen the benefit where, like the 3700X, it comes out, it doesn't have to be clocked way up to give you higher performance, but at the same time, because they didn't have to be really, really aggressive with the clocks, they didn't have to take that hit on power, so they could release that part at 65 watts. Now, the higher clock 3800X, that is 105 watt TDP part, and that's where they made that concession from power to just raw performance, and then the 3900X is 105 watts as well. But the amazing thing will be, and however long it takes to get enough of these, since obviously the 3950X will be a higher bend part, that's got all 16 cores enabled and running at higher boost clocks, even though the base clock will be a little bit lower. That's going to be ridiculous at 105 watts. I would love to see how much actual power that pulls, but, you know, this just this is basically obliterated the market. I say that, and of course anybody who's watching at Intel or anybody who has Intel systems and they have spent $1,200, $2,000 or more, $3,000 on a CPU, doesn't want to hear that this $500 CPU is eating their lunch. But really, Intel has to revisit their high-end desktop pricing at this point, because a 12-core, 24-thread part from Intel is $1,200. So right. For $1,200, I can buy a 3900, in theory, I could buy a 3900X, a decent motherboard in the $200 to $300 range, memory, storage, and a cheap case and power supply, and throw a system together. So it's for enthusiasts, this is an amazing time. And I wasn't around for, I wasn't covering this stuff when Athlon first came out, or when the Athlon XPs were kind of dominating things in the enthusiast circles, and Pentium 4 right. was considered kind of a slow platform, especially the initial launch where it was using Rambus before they went to DDR2 or DDR. So, I mean, there have been times in history where AMD was the lean and fast enthusiast platform, especially for gamers. And then it was like the Core came out. Core 2 Duo was what got me back onto Intel. And it's been several years where every build I did was Intel, Intel, Intel. And, you know, Bulldozer, Piledriver, those were disappointing to say the least. Terrible memory performance, bad overall performance, architectural issues, and it's kind of all changed. And I think their only real complaint about Zen before, and one of the things that Intel would have been quick to point out, was like the CCX to CCX, like this, the actual, they were basically like NUMA nodes. You had different CPUs communicating with each other over memory. And so performance was greatly affected by memory frequency. It's far less so with these new processors. Clearly, using faster memory is going to be an advantage. And AMD would love it if you would run at 3600. And they sent out 3600 memory with the review kits. But I was running all my tests at 3200 with some G-scale memory that's been around here for a while for testing APUs. And it ran perfectly fine and was very competitive with Intel on a clock-for-clock basis. Even though, and I know I've been talking for a while, but even though if you actually look at gaming benchmarks, that's where Intel still has the advantage. So if you are absolutely gaming first, I don't care about multi-threaded workloads. I don't care about rendering. I just want to play games at the absolute highest frames per second, then you would still buy an Intel processor, which that's probably not what AMD fans want to hear, but it's not huge. It's not the big lead it was before, but the 9900. Yeah, it's tangible. You can see it on the charts. Look at anybody's review. If you're gaming at lower resolutions, whereas that's when you're really forcing it to be more CPU bound, that's when you can prove that, okay, yeah, Intel still does have the advantage with gaming.
You know, it's interesting to look at, because you're getting, you know, I mean, one on like the Far Cry 5, which is kind of funny. The 3700X is, 3.8 frames per second faster than the Ryzen 7 3700, or the 3700X is 3.8 frames per second faster than the Ryzen 9 3900X. But, you know, you're looking at 142 frames per second, almost 20 frames per second faster for an i9-9900K, but, you know, you're paying a lot more money for that. No, actually, you're not. I take that back.
Well, it depends on which one you go with. Yeah, if you were to go with the 3700X, it's only 329. So
yeah.
And Intel's, actually, the better overall performance ended up being the i7-9700K, which is right. that sort of interesting 8-core non-hyper-threaded part. So the performance of that, if you're talking about like software mitigations or, you know, some of these mitigations they've had to put into place. And I was running all of this. Part of the reason this was such a daunting task was I had to redo every benchmark. Couldn't reuse anything old because I had to start from scratch on 1903, the newest version of Windows 10, right. which had scheduling improvements for Ryzen and also had, you know, more of the mitigations, coupled with the fact that I had the latest BIOS updates on these boards.
Right.
So even so, the 9700K just kind of blasts through gaming because it's just 8 fast cores, no SMT, no worries there. And it's kind of the better chip. If I was just going to buy an Intel chip today, and actually I might be using the 9700K on the gaming test bench going forward. But, you know, it's But still, I mean, the differences in frame times and overall frames per second averages between the latest Ryzen, we haven't tested any Ryzen 5 yet. I have a Ryzen 5 that'll be coming soon. But it's pretty minimal. It's not like a 20% disparity like it was in the beginning when Ryzen first came out. So if we're talking single-digit disparity and you're getting much higher productivity, much higher like workstation stuff, it's the same story that we've been talking about for the last 6 months, 8 months on this podcast, which is more cores for less money. And until Intel changes their product stack, until they change pricing, revisit HEDT somehow, and HEDT being like the sort of step down Xeon parts that we've always been able to get, like Ivy Bridge E and Skylake E and all of those hyper expensive, you know, extreme edition processors that are out there. But, you know, this changing the game, $499 to $749 when the 3950X comes out, that's going to be a crazy part too. $750 for a 16 core 32 thread part at 105
watts. It's going to be interesting to see how that does in some of the multi-threaded benchmarks. I mean, you know, I got to say the Core i7-9700K is a compelling processor at you know, $365. But I spend so much time doing stuff that's all multi-core all the time. And it's kind of like, oh, hey. I don't know. It's a good time to be, it's a really good time to be building a system, whether you're, you know, you're just about gaming or you're just about, you know, doing heavy multi-threaded work. Extreme Tech posted an article a couple, 3 hours ago. They have a leak that will be an Intel 10-core Comet Lake CPU to counteract the Ryzen 3000 family. A newly leaked roadmap purports to show what that response will be. As always, such leaks should be taken with a grain of salt, especially given the unusual nature of some of the predictions the slide makes. A new socket we haven't heard of before, hyperthreading returning to the high end, and quote, supposedly this is all quoted, the new CPUs are built on a 14-nanometer plus node.
Oh my gosh. You'd almost think this is fake just because of that. Would they really publish 14++++?
Well, as Mr. Ruska notes, that Intel has said they were retiring that nomenclature. So, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that Intel's going to have a response to this, one that will, of course, probably, you know, involve price adjustments. But,
yeah,
you know, it's interesting to see the sort of rumor mill starting to ramp up.
And who knows? Some of this might be intentional leaks. Maybe they just want to kind of silence the skeptics out there about Intel and their pricing. We pricing always becomes a big issue when new stuff comes out because the old stuff is out there. It's been out there.
Right.
And then retailers have stock. And then how is that working? What kind of contract do they have? Are they getting any kind of incentive to lower prices? Rebate offers start to appear, especially in the GPU world. So we'll talk about that when we talk about Super, because that basically screws up everything for add-in board partners who had RTX cards in the channel already. But
well, let's, I mean, you know, I was excited about the pricing on the 2700X, you know, being down at $254, but you know, that's not that much cheaper than a 3700X, which kind of beats it.
Beats the crap out of it. Yes.
You know, and I think it'll be really interesting to see. Oop, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the jump that I was most impressed about, because we haven't really seen 3900X is new territory outside of Intel's high-end desktop world. So to look at those results, it was more like, what can this do multi-threaded? This is amazing. Look at all these cores. But when I was just comparing apples to apples, basically, and an 8-core 16-thread part, which we've seen, that's been since the beginning of Ryzen, I compared the 1800X to the 2700X to the 3700X, and there's just huge gains from Zen Plus to Zen 2 at the same price point. We're still talking about $329. So if you have that money to spend, if you can possibly afford to move up from discounted 2700Xs on the market at around $250 to $329, you're getting a tremendous boost in performance without any additional power. And it'll run on your older board. So I don't see any reason to buy a 2700X anymore unless it's like $199.
There's a great TechSpot roundup where they looked at a Ryzen 9 3900X on B350 motherboard on a B350 motherboard. And it's interesting to look at, you know, the 570, like for Cinebench R20, you know, there's like a 2%, 4% difference in performance. 3900X was 4% faster on the X570 board, which also costs around 7 times more. Stephen Walton did the write-up on that for TechSpot. So literally, if you have an older motherboard, feel free to drop one of these processors into it at this point. You know, Blender numbers are effectively the same. V-Ray benchmark is a smidge faster, like 5% faster. But these are all low to mid single digit differences. It's a good article on TechSpot. I think memory support was their biggest challenge in some cases, but you know, and they basically said don't try to overclock your 12-core CPU on an older motherboard. No.
That's where you'd want to upgrade. Yes. If you're just running one of these at stock, these old platforms are fine, although you do get better memory support with the newer platform for sure. An X570 is great for memory support compared to older chipsets. And that's partly a function of running on the latest firmware on the board. Make sure you update the BIOS. But yeah, I mean, I didn't see really any performance detriment from what I was running on X570 to going back to X470.
Right.
You know, the single multi-threaded performance is very, very good on both.
Yay. Hey, let's take a moment to thank our sponsor. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by ExpressVPN, because we got a bunch more AMD news and some more news in other areas. Your packets, right? You got a computer, you got a connection to a network, whether it's Wi-Fi or Ethernet, it goes to the network in your office, or your house, it gets connected to the internet. If you don't think people are snuffing your packets, I guarantee you, if you work for a large corporation, they're looking at your packets. If you have an ISP, and you do, they're looking at your packets. If you think you're not being snooped on, or that nobody cares about your data, you're probably wrong about that. You know, your privacy is under attack. Your ISP wants to know what you're doing. It's frustrating, which is why I recommend getting a VPN, right? I use VPNs to protect my online activity, to keep what I do a little more private than it would be otherwise. ExpressVPN, you know, uses powerful encryption to secure your data. It runs in the background of your computer, your phone. It just lets you use the internet like you normally do. You download the app, you click to connect, you're protected. If you can click a button on your screen, you can get ExpressVPN running. I don't go online without a VPN, and you shouldn't either. ExpressVPN costs less than $7 a month, comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. ExpressVPN is using a new cutting-edge server technology called Trusted Server. Trusted Server prevents the operating system and apps from ever writing to the hard drive, they tell me, and it's a whole new standard of privacy and security. And look, people, it's time. You know, stop hackers, stop Big Brother, stop internet companies from grabbing all your data and figuring out exactly what you're doing and figuring out how to sell it and just, take back your online privacy with ExpressVPN. I just don't, you know, I don't go online in any public forum without a VPN. I like the added security. I like to have my packets encrypted. I find it frustrating when my ISP is tracking what I'm doing, which is why I use a VPN like ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a 1-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's expressvpn.com/twitch for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. That's expressvpn.com/TWICH to learn more. We want to thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. We've spent all this time talking about our enthusiasm for the next round of AMD CPUs. We should probably talk about the RX 5700 and RX 5700 XT, or as I like to think of it, watch out, NVIDIA 2060 Super. It's been a real good week for AMD.
And unexpected on this front, anyway. I was expecting good things from Ryzen, maybe not quite as good as they were. But RX 5700, which I thought was going to be kind of a disappointing product, honestly. My pessimistic outlook on this was, okay, Navi's coming, but they already warned us it's going to be mid-range. It's not going to be high-end. Radeon 7 right. came out, and that was just a die shrink of Vega 64 at higher clocks, faster memory, okay. It was kind of underwhelming if you looked at the price tag. And comparing it against what NVIDIA has, which is parts that have been criticized since the beginning for being so expensive. So then you've got AMD hitting RTX price points with Radeon 7 at $699 and not even beating it outside of, you know, more AMD favored game titles. It just didn't seem like a great product, not really to get excited about and not really available in large numbers and doesn't really need to be at $700. But so right. Navi's coming. Okay. It's mid range. The specs, we got the specs first, and the high end is the XT, the 5700 XT, which is only 40 compute units. So if you're thinking in terms of their existing graphics architecture that they've been using for 7 years, dropping from 64 compute units with Vega 10, which powered the Vega 64 and Vega 56, to 40 compute units with Navi 10, and that's a drop from 4,096 stream processors down to 2,560 stream processors. It seemed like it's going to be really, really underwhelming. It seemed that way. And yes, I sat mm-hmm. through explanation of the new architecture, very, very low level exploration of how the RDNA graphics architecture actually differs from Graphics Core Next and why this really is a new architecture and not just, they're not renaming it, respinning it, it's new. Mm-hmm. We kind of all listened to that. Okay, sure. But the specs, I mean, this is a mid... And then it comes out, and I'm holding the XT here. This is the reference design, which I've seen some criticism online. I've been chided a little bit about this because it's like, well, did it melt? Did you drop it? Because of the dent on the top of it. And I kind of like the design. It looks more like a car fender, kind of automotive-inspired design right. to me. But yeah, I mean, and people hate that it's a blower. It's a blower cooler, which I, you know, that most people seem to absolutely hate those for various reasons, which is, you know, it's valid. But regardless, forget about the design and the cooler. The GPU mm-hmm. itself is going to live on past these reference designs and be a part of the third-party boards that come out, the MSI Twin Frozers of the world and the Asus Strix of the world. Navi 10 is really, really impressive. And what they're doing with fewer compute units, fewer streaming processors, is even the lower end non-XT RX 5700 in most benchmarks that I ran at 1440, which is 2560 by 1440, is putting more stress on the GPU than a 1080p test. Even though most people game at 1080p, that brings the CPU into play a little bit more. That's why we like to use that for CPU benchmarking. But at higher resolutions, it's beating a Vega 64 handily in most tests. I think only one of the tests I ran did a Vega 64 outperform the 5700. And the 5700 XT is significantly outperforming a Vega 64. The Vega 56 has become almost irrelevant at this point. I mean, we've seen deals right. yet again last night, seeing deals where after a $60 rebate, it's down to $279. But still, I would spend my money on the 5700. Forget the 56. The 5700 is beating a Vega 64 for $349. So that is the price of the RTX 2060. It outperforms a 2060. And it's coming close to like around the same performance as a 2060 Super. When you look at the 5700 XT and you look at the results of the 2070, which is what they had kind of positioned the 5700 XT against. So RTX 2070 equals RTX 2060 Super, roughly, as far as performance goes. So now we've got a card for $399, which is the 5700 XT. The 5700 sells for $349. And of course, this is, if you've been following this saga, they announced pricing at $349 for the XT. And I think it was $379 for the 5700. And they dropped it to $399 and $349 before launch in response to, or whether you believe in conspiracy theories or not, either in response to NVIDIA or after baiting NVIDIA to release them at a certain price and then actually announcing the real prices, which they'd been planning all along. Who knows? These prices actually do make sense.
It doesn't really matter.
It doesn't. I mean, what matters is what actually people can buy these for. So if they are cheaper at launch, then great. And we'll talk about Super. But to me, looking at how much this architecture has improved things, it does it from the very, it's basically pushing way more data per clock. And not without going into a low-level discussion of what I can't even remember about all the charts and everything I've digested about RDNA. We'll have a breakdown of RDNA at some point on PCPro.com as our own Josh Walrath goes through all of those slides and kind of parses everything and dissects it all. But it's really, really impressive what they're doing. They've basically taken some of the Zen architecture on the CPU side into the GPU side and improved efficiencies, completely redone the level one cache, and a lot more data is being pumped through. So it's not the most power efficient it could have been moving to 7 nanometers, but they're getting way more work done with this new architecture as well. And still, there's good power savings. It's not sipping power. It's still like an 8-pin and a 6-pin connector, but it's doing a heck of a lot more than we saw with Polaris. I would not recommend anybody buy a Polaris card at this point, which I'm sure AMD does not want to hear, but why buy a 580 or a 590 when there's got to be some variants of this coming that'll be hitting lower price points? I would love to see Navi everything from AMD. A high-end Navi with all 64 CUs would be tremendous.
What's also crazy about this is the 5700 is available both on Amazon and Newegg. Newegg still has the 5700 XT in stock, and they're all selling for their launch price, the $349 for the 5700 and $399 for the 5700 XT. And I'm just delighted that Newegg is, you know, okay, it would be nice if they had the 3,000, more the Ryzen 7 and Ryzen 9 3,000 processors. But at this point, any GPU company actually shipping a new model and it actually being available for purchase several days after the announcement is kind of impressive. Or maybe nobody's buying any of them at this point. But this is... I'm with you. Vega's dead to me.
And we didn't even mention like one of the features of Vega from the beginning, this new architecture from AMD when we first saw like the Fury X, and then we saw the Vega 6456 come out, and Radeon 7 is still on GCN using high bandwidth memory, and these new graphics cards are using GDDR6, and it's the same speed, 14 gigabit per second GDDR6, as NVIDIA is using, and it's just a mainstream, far less expensive to implement, and I think this will get really, really interesting when we start seeing those $200 to $300 graphics cards, where AMD should, by all indications, have something that will compete with the likes of the 1660s of the world from NVIDIA and replace an aging 1060 in somebody's system in the next 6 months to a year. So,
well, let's take a moment to talk about the super cards, right? No super cards up on Amazon that I can tell. They do have RTX 2060 supers. Several of them are available at Newegg. selling for $350 to $400, depending on which variation you're getting. How is that stacking up? I mean, you know, the RTX 2070 Super is, you said, within about 10% of an RTX 2080. You know, is do we have a real fight in the GPU world going on right now?
Well, they've certainly made it more difficult for AMD to compete by doing this, because they basically lowered prices. It's not like they rebranded. It was interesting. We were asking the question, so is this basically the same thing as a 2070? Because the 2060 Super numbers, the specifications are different.
Right.
If you actually look at core count, CUDA cores, you drop from 2304 with a 2070 to 2176. That's not that big of a drop. You're going from 36 right. SMs to 34. So everything's a little bit lower, but the clocks are higher, and it kind of negates the difference. In practice, within a frame or two, these are the same card, even though it's a different configuration of the same GPU. It's TU106, slightly different configurations, and the RTX 2060 Super, which is $399, the starting price, is basically giving you an RTX 2070, which was a $499 graphics card. So it's like they did a $100 price drop on RTX 2070. It's just called 2060 right. Super. It's a slightly different configuration of the same Turing GPU. And then the 2070 Super is interesting. It's a little bit more of a drop from the 2080. It's still the same TU104 GPU, as far as we know, and it dropped not just two SMs, it actually dropped six, so it's 40 SMs, which translates to 2560 cores instead of 2944, and again, higher clocks, higher base and boost clocks,
right?
But in this case, the same number of texture units and ROPs, unless I'm completely mistaken. So it's pretty close, within, it's like single digits percentage away from a 2080. And the 2070 Super replaces the 2070 in their product stack at $499. The 2070 and 2080 are going away. They're basically being unofficially end-of-lifed. And you're only going to see, once inventory disappears from retail channels, you're only going to see 2070 Super and 2080 Super cards. The 2080 Super is not out yet. It won't be out till the end of this month. And we've been given specs on that. It is not quite to a 2080 Ti. It's not like we're getting a 2080 Ti for $699. But it's going to be interesting, because the 2080 Super has really, really fast memory. So it's the fastest they've ever released at NVIDIA. It's going to be 15.5 gigabit per second memory, even though there is a pretty big reduction in CUDA cores from a Ti. We've heard rumors about it being within about 20% of a TI. And maybe it'll even be within only 10% of a TI. We have no idea. But that's going to get really interesting, because the TI at $1,000 to $1,200, the 2080 TI, that's really in Titan territory. And it's not just in Titan territory. It just should have been called a Titan. I've had a problem with NVIDIA's branding. To get them my soapbox here. Their branding with RTX from the very beginning was off, and they don't pay me to make decisions. Unfortunately, I would, you know, like, I'll consult here. Here's what you should have done, because they had to sort of backtrack a little bit, and they released the GTX cards, or maybe that was their plan all along. I don't know. But we talked about this earlier this year when they released the 1660 and 1660 Ti. They were releasing new GPUs that didn't have the Turing cores, and at lower price points, and kind of were the drop-in replacements. Like 1660 was the thing that actually replaced the 1060. But if you were a consumer looking like, okay, well, I've gone from 760 to 960 to 1060, and now here's the 2060. What? 2060 is $349. This isn't a mid-range card. I don't need RTX. I wouldn't even run RTX at that price point. And so, you know, now that the dust has kind of settled and they've had some time to think it over and they've had some competition from AMD, the super cards make a lot of sense, because they're higher level of performance at the same price point. It's starting to make, like, 2070 now becomes really accessible. At $499, you're getting that really high end experience that people were, that they looked at that $500 price level from the Pascal era. We were used to like 2 years of $499 buys you one of the fastest gaming cards on the planet. And then
right.
from 1080 to 2080, it's like, oh, well, now $699 buys you one of the fastest gaming cards on the planet. And if you want the fastest, it's $1,200. And that's a very difficult to justify. And now it's, well, $499 actually buys you close to a 2080. And $399 buys you a 2070 level of performance. I don't know why they're keeping it in the product stack, but the RTX 2060 lives on and at $349. I would have thought that would have dropped to like $299, but hey.
Right.
But just
maybe they're waiting for the Super.
The Super is right here. This is the 2060 Super. As you can see, it has a chrome front plate. So you can see my monitor in the reflection there, but
it's very shiny.
This is literally the same design as the 2060. With just its single 8-pin power connector on the back there, if you have the Founders Edition. But this is now 2070 performance all day in every game. And it's to get that for $399 to me is the most compelling part of this. Even though the 2070 Super was a bigger uplift in performance, might actually be the better deal because the 2080 is $200 more than this card. So it's... What are your thoughts on this, Patrick? Because I dominate this conversation. You know, sorry.
Well, it was I was strolling through the benchmarks and I was having one of those moments where, depending on your game, the difference between you know, a 5700, a 5700 XT, and the super cards is, you know, either striking to the tune of maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15. In I think one benchmark, I saw something. It was probably in the neighborhood of 20%. No, make that 10 or 15. More like 15%. But it's amazing to me how much variation in GPU performance there is based on I think a lot of it's either what's going on inside of the game, whether or not the game has actually been properly optimized in the drivers or by the manufacturer. For me, looking at this, I'm wondering how many of these, you know, like F1 2018 running at 2560 by 1440, you know, an RTX 2080 Founders Edition is running at 175 frames per second. That's almost 10 frames per second faster than a Radeon 7 or an RTX 2070 Super. And that those two cards are roughly eight frames per second faster than a 5700 XT. And then you start dropping down a lot as you get into the 2060 Super, the 2070, and kind of rolling downhill from there. You know, but you're looking at, you know, the RX 5700, 132 frames per second. You're jumping up 24 frames per second to a 5700 XT, and then, you know, almost 30 frames per second faster. And, you know, I guess it depends on, A, how... You know, if you're playing a game where you are desperate for the ultimate frame rates, you know, or if you're looking at something, it's, you know, maybe, you know, like Ashes of the Singularity, where the spread between, you know, an RTX 2070 and a RTX 2080, you know, is something in the neighborhood of 8 frames per second, and another frame per second gets you the AMD Radeon 7. I don't know. This is not a particularly, you know, brilliant insight, but I'm pointing out once again that it is amazing how different cards will look based on what games or what type of games you are running. And yeah, as and always,
I will point out. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, and always, this can change dramatically based on driver updates, you know, from NVIDIA or AMD, or optimizations made by the developers in the game itself.
Yes. A game engine update can have a huge impact. Case in point, while I was benchmarking on the CPU side, because I was using a different set of benchmarks and kind of updating them when I was doing that, because these unfortunately... I had to fall back on all of my benchmarking I've done throughout the year. So this is 6 months worth of benchmarks where I added the Radeon XT you know, the 5700 series and the Super to those results that we've been talking about since January. So that needs to be redone. And that's one of the problems is you mentioned the high frame rates. It's not a great test of a GPU to throw a game at it where it can put out 170 plus frames per second at 1440 high. So I think going forward, I need to update the games, run at ultra settings, really, and at higher resolutions, maybe even throw in some 4K testing because these cards are getting so much faster. 4K is starting to look viable. If you're hitting 170 frames per second at high detail settings at 1440, I'm curious to see what these cards could do. Can I get consistently above 60 with high detail settings at 4K? Probably, depending on the game. But you know, workloads, you talked about like sometimes it's a graphics engine thing. When I was testing on the CPU side, World War Z was a game that I had been testing all along. It's a game that's DX11 and Vulkan. So I was running it at Vulkan, ultra settings, and I was running 1.10, version 1.10 of the game. Halfway through, of course, I go down, start benchmarking again, Epic, which is always online, starts updating the game for me. And at the end of the update, it was on version 2.something and tremendous improvement in performance where I had to throw out all of my benchmarks because, like, I can't compare these. The new version of this engine is completely different. And the same thing happened to me with Shadow of the Tomb Raider. There's been a massive game engine update with that game. I was talking to one of the technical people at NVIDIA about it. I'm like, this game with the new supercard is going like 40 frames per second faster than it should be based on my old data on like the 2080 and the 2070. Like, no. They had a huge engine update, which of course I had not noticed. Then benchmark that game in a while, look into it, like, oh crap, this did update. And I have to redo all testing on Shadow of the Tomb Raider. And this is one of those things where ideally with any graphics card launch, we would retest everything on the latest version of Windows with the latest drivers, with the latest version of the game engine all over again. And if I had a staff of like 10 people benchmarking, I could just do that. Like you benchmark all these games all over again today. I want new benchmarks every time a graphics driver is released, but it doesn't always happen. It's worth revisiting though. It'd be fun to see how these mature because Radeon 7 definitely matured from launch. Graphics drivers got better and obviously game engines changed as we just mentioned. So this is pre-launch driver, press driver results with both of these on the NVIDIA and AMD side. So, like I said in the reviews, preliminary. I'm still really, really impressed with both of these. I think Super was exactly what they needed to do. I would have loved to see the 2060 come out as the direct replacement to the 1060 and maybe have like a 2060 RTX. If they did what they used to do, like the 8800 series, think about it. There was an 8800 GT, an 8800 GTX. They used to append the product name with the performance level, basically. And it becomes kind of confusing for consumers when it's, well, the new series is the 20 series, except when it doesn't have RT cores, and then it's called the 16 series, which is still higher than the 10 series, but it's new architecture. It's not Pascal again. It's actually Turing, but the 1660 is a Turing without RT cores, even though the whole point of Turing is that it has RT cores, and that's why the die is so much bigger than it was with Pascal, and so on and so on. So,
yeah, that does make your head hurt.
It does. It hurts to say it. I don't even know if I'm making any sense at this point. We should probably move
on. On a completely random note, let's just slide right over. You know, there's rumors that Samsung's building the latest 7-nanometer NVIDIA GPUs. Scott did a nice write-up on that at PCPro.com. Digitimes, that was originally back in June. Digitimes was talking about that. Tom's Hardware picked it up. NVIDIA, of course, as Scott writes, do not comment on rumors and speculation. Then, of course, a couple hours later, commented on rumors and speculation with an official statement from the executive VP of operations, Deborah Schoquist. Recent reports are incorrect. NVIDIA's next generation GPU will continue to be produced at TSMC. NVIDIA already uses both TSMC and Samsung for manufacturing. We plan to use both foundries for our next generation GPU products. Whether or not that actually happens is anybody's guess, and how you would tell the difference between them, who knows? But, you know, the other thing that happened was Josh, you know, did a nice write-up on the Asus ROG Strix RTX 2060 06G. And, you know, it's a 2060. 2060 did not get killed off, or is not expected to be killed off at this stage by the super announcements, as Sebastian pointed out earlier. The question is whether or not a $419 GPU is worth buying, given what it's competing against, both from AMD and from NVIDIA. I thought this was kind of peculiar.
Yeah, the timing of this review was off, and this is he doesn't have the latest stuff to compare it against. This is a project he started in his own time. I think it was earlier in the year. So of course, right, now with Super coming out, it kind of steals the thunder of this review, but it's nonetheless interesting to look at. Like you said, since NVIDIA made the choice to keep RTX 2060 on the market as is, meaning the cards start at $349, this is the problem. And this is why I thought this was actually a relevant review to publish when I did, which is, okay, so these are still on the market. This is a heavily overbuilt, heavily overclocked from the factory video card. And right, so it commands a premium over the $349 price. But at what point, even with the rebates and different offers we've seen on this, you're still looking at a best case scenario of $389 after all the rebates. Right. So is the $10 savings you get over a 2060 Super, just a vanilla card you'll find somewhere, worth it? And, you know, he doesn't have a Super yet. He has one that's on its way. But, you know, just looking at it compared to the RX 580, the Vega 56, the 1070 that he's been using for a long time as his personal gaming GPU.
Right.
It's tremendously faster most of the time, but the pricing thing is just, I feel for these add-in partners a bit, I guess. I don't really know the pricing agreements that they have and what kickbacks they might get, but it's got to hurt to try to sell a $419 card that's already been rendered obsolete, and NVIDIA is not discontinuing your 2060. So what are they supposed to do?
I don't know. Probably eat the cost. They eat the cost, or they cut the lineup, or they cut it early, or, you know, whatever else you do when whatever else you do when your model gets kind of undermined by the release of a product you weren't entirely expecting. It's a tough question. And I'll be honest with you, I think for the majority of the people that are listening to this podcast, it's probably kind of a moot question, because why would you pay that much when you could buy something faster for not much more? To say that, you know, there aren't various reasons for buying these boards, but I think more often than not, the focus is always like, how do I get something faster for less money? Unexpected announcement this week. Creative celebrates 30 years of Sound Blaster with new AE9 and AE7 sound cards. It's been interesting because Creative still shows up. They show up at CES. They show up at actually a lot of they showed up at Cedia this year, which is the installers, the big home theater installers gathering. They show up occasionally at some of the audio shows. You know, Creative Technology Limited continues its legacy of revolutionizing audio with the launch of its most advanced PCI Express sound cards ever, the Sound Blaster AE9 and Sound Blaster AE7, built with only the most premium components and complemented with the latest technologies from Creative. These sound cards are designed to define a new performance standard in this class for the ultimate PC entertainment experience, which you pretty much have to do given how good the audio has gotten on most motherboards in general, and premium motherboards in particular. You know, And they do something that's super popular in the audiophile community, which is like, oh, they've got Nichicon fine gold capacitors and Wima film foil audio capacitors. You can swap or roll, to use the term of art in the audiophile community, op amps. You know, I love that Sound Blaster is doing their best to continue to make sure that there are discrete components that are looking for the ultimate audio performance. The numbers I have seen in terms of benchmarking the performance of, for example, changing different op apps does not lend a huge amount of interest from me for the idea of like, I'm going to try different op apps or I'm going to swap different chips inside the board. I worked for a on and off for a year or two in a building where one of the guys down in the basement designed boards that were for professional studios. And he designed, when you look at a big rack of audio equipment, you know, when they've got the 48 tracks and all of the sliders and the little preamps to adjust for all of the different, microphones running into the board that makes for a multi-track recording. His business was essentially recreating classic boards that were no longer being manufactured or boards that gave the audio equivalent of those older designs. And I asked him, I'm like, you know, do you use high-end capacitors? And he laughed. He said, well, you know, I'll use capacitors that have a higher thermal rating because they tend to be better built. But the idea that there's a sort of audiophile capacitor is kind of ridiculous. You know, I'm really curious to see, you know, for example, they're talking about, you know, a DNR of 129 decibels on the AE9. That would be really, really impressive. That would be a really silent card, which is a big plus. You know, there's still, you know, it's $349, you know, with a discrete X-amp headphone by amplifier on that one, which, you know, if it delivers the kind of performance they're promising, is a pretty slick configuration. You know, and then the AE7 is an upgrade to the AE5. You know, 32-bit, 384 kilohertz if you're into high-end audiophiles, DSD64 playback capabilities via an ESS Saber 9018 DAC if you are into high-definition audio. You know, so it's cool to see they're doing this. These are not expensive boards. Although you can get a 15% discount as a existing Sound Blaster owner if you have proof of purchase on that one. You know, I think I'm just in love with the idea they're just doing basic, you know, lots and lots of high quality, you know, stereo audio. I mean, you know, they still got the SBX stuff built into there, but it doesn't seem to be sort of the focus, which is, yeah. I'm just not a huge fan of a lot of the 3D audio processing. They look nice.
They do. I'd like to see whether or not they're using like dual clock oscillators and if it has a native 44.1 and 48 right. Sample rates and this, that kind of stuff. That's what we saw with the new audio card. That was very good. The one from EVGA, which is currently right. Selling for the same price as this AE7 at $229. So I did reach out to them. I don't have a contact with them, but I emailed them anyway and said, hey, I'd love to review right. One of these, but we will see. One of the things, though, that struck me about this, since it's an anniversary celebration, like, where are the green PCBs? Where is the throwback to the Sound Blaster? Maybe even a Game Blaster throwback. You know, maybe it's not practical, and maybe nobody but me and a few other people on Earth would even want one of these things, but throw some stuff out there on the ISA bus again. How about recreate the original Game Blaster in the original packaging? Like, you know, the Nintendo consoles have enjoyed a renaissance with the NES Mini and the SNES Mini, and now we have the Genesis Mini, the rather terrible PlayStation Mini already came out. Capitalize on this trend by serving a market of 10 to 15 people globally with reimagined Game Blaster cards in vintage packaging. Creative, if you're watching, I would buy one. Sound Blaster 16, AWE64. Like, there's a lot of classic cards that help define PC audio. Like, Sound Blaster compatibles were game audio for a very long time.
Yes, they were.
Even though I thought when I saw this, I'm like, release the old cards or like, you know, simulated version of the old cards on PCIe. That makes no sense because the games would not work. They would not understand the PCI Express bus.
I was trying so hard not to say that.
No, I know.
For the several gamers in North America and around the world that are currently using ISA bus motherboards.
Hey, vintage gaming is a thing. You know, check the LGR exists.
Given the number of ISA boards that you can dig out of garages and landfills around the world, it's probably not a super compelling market for them. Well, you know, the joke I was thinking is they probably couldn't do the green color because it's, you know, it turns out they have some sort of toxic dye inside of it.
if I have any input next time, it'll be green. Come on, guys. Green PCB. You guys defined this market for so long. Throwback. Throwbacks are popular right now, obviously. People are having their midlife crisis, me. So we want that old stuff that we couldn't necessarily afford when we were young, and we're ogling it in the Radio Shack catalog.
Well, so to switch speeds a little bit, the other thing that kind of came out this week, the Nintendo Switch Lite. I liked Kotaku's write-up. The Nintendo Switch Lite has sealed the 3DS's coffin. And in case you're wondering what a Nintendo Switch Lite is, you know, the Nintendo Switch is like $300 with a pair of red and blue Joy-Cons off of Amazon. The Nintendo Switch Lite is going to sell for $200. And you notice it's kind of has the Joy-Cons built in because it's a handheld Switch. Quote, dedicated to handheld play, the system for gamers on the go, i.e. for everybody who's tired of fluffing around with Joy-Cons and having parts and you know, attaching and detaching their Switch from their television. Now you can just have a Switch for the go, the Switch Lite. And you can, you know, save 30% off the cost of a Switch. So
I'm curious what SoC is in that, I wonder. Like, if they, because the thing about the dock with the Switch was that it actually ran at a higher clock speed if you docked it than if you did not. So if they've got a die shrink or maybe even a revision to the SoC, maybe it's actually running at the docked speed. But who knows? Can't have everything.
Yeah, I'm not seeing a lot of technical details.
Oh yeah, they Nintendo won't. I've only read rumors. And I don't know what it is about the Nintendo fans, but whenever a new product is announced, they aren't content with the fact that it's going to be great, that they're going to like it, that it's going to cater to them, that it's going to have the Mario and the Zelda games and all that stuff. It also, for some reason, has to be the fastest, which I never understood. Right. Like the Wii U, as maligned a system as that was, the Wii U is very close to the performance of the Switch. Certainly, it is higher performance than the Switch when the Switch is undocked. And some of the numbers that came out about the Switch, which is, this is an oversimplification, but the Switch is essentially an NVIDIA Shield tablet running custom software with a different shell on it. But that's kind of what it is. The Shield tablet didn't really sell in big numbers. It doesn't exactly have wide adoption out there, but the Switch certainly does. So it was not to the level of perhaps the Amazon Kindle being the, what was that? The BlackBerry Fire? Not Fire. But Playbook. The BlackBerry Playbook was rebranded the Fire, and that became Amazon's first tablet, but that's another story. These chips existed, and Nintendo got a really good deal. That's all that's my theory.
Well, that, X1. I think they realized, I mean, given I think it took them like a year to sell as many Nintendo Switches as they did. What's the one we've all forgotten about? The Wii.
You may have forgotten about it, but you almost assuredly have one somewhere in your house.
I don't. There's a strict no consoles rule in my house that involves my wife, not me. But, you know, it's convenient that it allowed me to open a gateway to my children to PC gaming. But don't forward that to her if you know her on Facebook. The reaction will be short, sharp, and unpleasant, primarily for me. But no, it's yeah, I think this is kind of a Nintendo has a huge community of Switch gamers, and now they are going to sell as many of them as they can, a smaller, more portable device. And then they will probably also sell a whole bunch of these to people that did not want to pay $300 for a Switch.
True. Yes.
You know, go Nintendo. So with that, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, my goodness. I am still very excited about the Raspberry Pi 4. I'm just going to leave that there. And
even with this USB-C issues, Patrick?
You know.
Don't you want to wait for Rev B now? That's my excuse. I didn't buy one, and then I couldn't buy one with the higher, you know, memory. And then I'm like, well, I'm just waiting for Rev B. That's what it is. That's what it was all along. I knew they were going to have USB-C issues. So that's my story.
You did you? Well, yeah. I mean, you know, yeah. Here, let me cut and paste this into the rundown so there's a nice. Insert one below. I'm just going to read this. It's from The Verge. John Porter wrote it up. The Raspberry Pi Foundation messed up its first USB-C device. E-marked cables detected as an audio accessory and refused to power it. So, buggy USB port that prevents many popular charging cables from supplying power. The port is the device's sole input for power, leaving some owners thinking they've purchased a lemon. Tyler Ward was the first person to write this up, and AKA Scorpia. And let me put that in there because, you know, he deserves to be recognized for discovering this heartbreaking moment on Raspberry Pi 4.
Well, that sounds like if you use their officially sanctioned power supply, then you won't have the issue then, right? Because they've at least tested that.
Right.
But most other USB-C sources are going to be problematic.
The biggest challenge is people trying to run it with MacBook chargers.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Ward notes that, like, literally in the first paragraph. Eben Upton from the Raspberry Pi Foundation has commented that he expects this will be fixed in a future board revision in comments reported on Tech Republic. Nobody knows what the timing is. It's a little frustrating because it's nerdy. The root cause of the problem is that the shared CC pull-down resistor on the USB Type-C connector, looking at the reduced Pi schematics, we can see is R79. With most charges, this won't be an issue as basic cables only use one CC line, which is connected through the cable, and as a result, the Pi will be detected correctly and receive power. The problems comes with E-marked cables with used both CC connections, and then it gets into the Type-C specification document, what an EE device is. You know, how the spec deals with that. And, with two RA values or resistance values presented to the source, it will detect the Pi as an audio adapter accessories. And, there are analog audio differences to allow for headphones to be connected to phones without things going squirrely. The biggest challenge is like E-marked cables and using a non-E-marked cable, i.e. most USB-C phone charger cables, rather than an E-marked cable, i.e. a laptop charger / Thunderbolt cable or 85-amp ampable cable, will allow the Pi to be powered on. So it's an issue, but it's only an issue if, A, you're trying to use your laptop charger or B, a particularly powerful – or, you know, a laptop-capable charging cable or a Thunderbolt cable. So
let me be incredibly snarky here then, which is, you know, unprecedented on this podcast. But it sounds to me like this is possibly being a little overinflated by the kind of tech journalists who would only have anything made by Apple around them. So then they're like, oh, USB-C, that's on my MacBook. Oh, it doesn't power this Raspberry Pi. As if anybody in their right mind would put an 85-watt charger into a Raspberry Pi. Or would just use their Android phone charger to power it, which would be not problematic at all. So the pull quote, which is, the USB cable situation is confusing and messy. Well, that's you and your iPhone fast charger, which isn't powering your Raspberry Pi properly. You've never owned an Android device. Rant over.
Possibly. Here, I'm plugging in a... Oh, that's powering up. Yeah, I was pretty sure I'd use it. Yeah, you know, sorry, I was grabbing a random laptop charger to plug it into the Raspberry Pi just for the sheer unbridled joy of seeing if it powered
and
up.
And you have the 4, right?
Yeah.
You have the 4.
That was the thing you just dropped on the floor. No. The keyboard dropped in the floor. I managed to clutch the soap bar of the Raspberry Pi 4 in my grubby little paw. I haven't run into something that wouldn't power it yet. I just may not have the sort of sophisticated cables necessary to create that issue.
You're just not using only Apple chargers for everything, Patrick. That's your problem. You'd know what a widespread issue this was if the only USB-C you had in your house was white and came from the Apple store.
I have not tried to charge it with the charger from my ThinkPad, so I'll try that next. How's that?
Sure.
Let me just grab this, you know, gigantic high-powered USB-C connector and use it on my relatively low-power Raspberry Pi, just because. It's unfortunate. I mean, the short of it is, and one of the things that, for example, Mr. Porter points out at the end of his article is that, you know, U.S. instances like this are all too common with USB-C. And then he calls out the work by Benson Leung and Nathan Kay, who are dealing with the early implementations of USB-C charging and the problems that created with really, really bad cables and really, really bad chargers in the early days of USB-C implementation on cell phones. So, you know, this is USB-C has been kind of frustrating in part because of cheap vendors making stupid decisions and then selling those products on Amazon, and in part because it always seems like there's one more complication in the USB-C spec as they sort of stretched it to cover more and more possible scenarios. I am not bothered by this, quite frankly, sir.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I led you down this rabbit hole. It's been probably a 10 to 15 minute journey. And
all these people at home I could be mowing the lawn right now. Or maybe you are mowing the lawn and you're glad that we're still talking on like this.
True.
PCPer.com, we can expect more benchmarks as 570 motherboards ship that actually work, or firmware updates ship that make 570 motherboards work. I feel we can expect updates to the 3900X review or 3700X reviews on PCPer.com.
Absolutely. In fact,
okay, worried there. There was silence there.
Silence as I didn't realize that was a cue, and I was, of course, staring at the chat here. And agreeing with Burke, agreeing with me, which is, you know, always what I want to see. But no, yeah, X570. I mean, I've got one back here. This, as I tip everything over, I got this Steel Legend board in yesterday. I've got a, this is one I've been working on. I'll have this one probably first. It's a Crosshair 8 Hero Wi-Fi. It's the Hero that I need, especially after my issues with the other board. And, you know, I've been assured that the shipping retail board that I had, the version of the board that I had, is not problematic. And in fact, they're shipping me another board. So I'll have an MSI board to review soon. I have to, you know, figure out what I'm getting from Gigabyte at this point. But yeah, I mean, this board, it's going to be boards all the rest of this month, probably in August into September, as we get some other, I get some help and we get through some of these motherboards. We actually start comparing, like, you know, these X570 board started around $160. So is there that much of an advantage in spending? I think this ROG board is around $350, somewhere right in there. So do you get that much more out of your CPU in one of these boards versus like a $200 motherboard? So we will see. And I have yet to test any PCIe 4, although I do have this collection of parts in my hand right here, which I'm dropping. The sum total of what's in my hand becomes the MP600, which is this right here. So this is a PCI Express 4 solid state drive, which comes with, I can get the lighting on this properly, maybe not. So it comes with this, you know, heat sink assembly, because these are not cool. These pull quite a bit of voltage for an SSD, and they require some pretty beefy heat sinks. This thing's about a half inch tall. So, good luck fitting your graphics card over this. If there's any kind of like M.2 slot clearance issues, you'll be like kind of moving around where the M.2 drive is with these. But anyway, doing some storage testing on that, getting higher speed memory working. 3733, if I'm not mistaken, is the high frequency. Could be wrong about that. But overclock memory over 4,000 should be possible. And in fact, some vendors are already shipping 4,000 memory kits for Ryzen 3000. So there's a lot of stuff to explore with this platform still. I mean, and testing the latest AGESA 1.0.0.3 firmware versus 1.0.0.2 and checking out boost frequencies and all that sort of thing. So it's, yeah, there's initial reviews out there, and people, as the dust settles and people get some sleep and revisit this stuff, it's going to continue to be interesting for at least the rest of this month. And then, you know, there's far more X570 boards out there than we'll ever be able to get to, but that's we'll get to however many we can.
Seems like you won't
I'm just
be
laughing.
Bored.
No.
No, I won't be bored testing X570. Although, doing any kind of motherboard testing in general, it's like GPU testing, only more intense because there's so many more aspects of it you could test. It's monotonous. And I don't want to do it full time.
It takes a certain level of intensity and patience. Not that you don't have these things, but
I don't have enough. I have discovered this about myself. I'm willing to admit what my limitations are. I am not a genius of microarchitecture. I marvel at people who can just rattle off all of these things and understand all the nuances of the microarchitectural composition and topology of these different chips. But that's fascinating to me. I'm more interested in performance and testing things. But when you look at motherboard testing, you could get lost. I get lost. I don't know where to stop. I want to test the 3.1 Gen 2. I want to test the ASMedia versus maybe the native built-in USB. I want to test storage. I want to test SATA storage and NVMe storage. And, you know, it never ends.
Oh, my goodness. On a completely random note, part of the reason I kept looking over to the right is because I was marveling at the fact that you can get Newegg will email you. They'll give you a blast, an update, when the 3900X is in stock. The 3700X, right? You can get auto-notified for when the AMD Ryzen 7 3700X is in stock. There is, however, no update available for the 3900X. It just says currently sold out, which of course had me checking to see if there were any updates on the Amazon Prime front. And there is one Prime AMD Ryzen 7 3700X in stock on Amazon for $399.99. So a mere $70 over the MSRP.
Markup. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to hold off, as tempting as that is.
There was only one 3900X, I think on the 8th, or I don't remember what day it was, I was looking now. Oh, it was only one on eBay that was actually in hand, where they were taking pictures of it and had the receipt.
Right.
And it was already over MSRP with like a day left, and then it just disappeared. So I don't know who bought it, who made whatever offer to get that person to take the listing down, but it's not like these are all over eBay and people are scalping them. No, they're just sold out and not available. People who want them would actually want to keep them and use them.
Well, this is good. I'm not, however, going to pay 3800X prices for a 3700, I guess. Not this week.
You say that now. Wait a few days, and you still can't get your hands on one. And you're like, you know what? He says he has it in stock. It's only $50 over MSRP.
Well, this one's, I mean, this is an actual Amazon Prime fulfilled 3700X for $400. And I'm just not feeling the need to pay an extra $70 for that chip, which maybe means I'm just not a hardware enthusiast, or maybe it means I want to see what the overclocking numbers look like when the 570 boards are out, and whether or not the incredible expense of a 570 board is justifying my time. So if I got like a 450 or 470, I'm going to stop now. PCPro.com is a place to find Sebastian's work, including his updates as the 570 boards actually start to work with the 3700 and 3900X. This, ladies and gentlemen, is a show called Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware. You can find all the older episodes, how to subscribe, and some adorable pictures of Sebastian and I over at twitch.tv/Twitch. My name is Patrick Norton. We are... This Week in Computer Hardware is one of the primary gigs I have right now. AVXL.com is a home theater and audio podcast. And there will be some other projects coming up in my none-too-distant future. And as soon as those are up and running, I will give you all a heads up here. In the meantime, hold off. There'll be more 3700Xs. There'll be more 3800Xs. There'll be more 3900Xs, we hope. I'm not holding my breath too hard in that last one. But and if not... Boy, there's some absolutely fantastic Intel processors, especially if you're a gamer. Keep focused here. Do not buy the Vega GPUs. Just don't.
Patrick has spoken.
Hold
out for Navi. Hold out for Navi if you possibly can.
Hold out for
Forget
Navi.
Polaris. Polaris is gone. It's ancient history. Vega, you know, it's cute. It's there. It's nice. Navi. Navi's where it's at. Navi's going to power the new... graphics, they're going to power the new consoles. The desktop graphics parts that we've seen so far are very impressive.
Right.
So if you can possibly afford it, don't buy a Vega 56 or a Vega 64. Unless you get just an amazing fell off the back of the truck deal on it. But make sure it wasn't used for some hardcore mining for several months and probably has weeks, if not only days, of life left on it.
Well... that's a whole nother conversation.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've been listening to This Week in Computer Hardware, twit.tv/Twitch. I'm Patrick Norton.
And I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.